We'll call the Senate, the Senate Environmental Natural Resource Committee to order Thursday, March 8th, 2012. Approximately 35 minutes late. Sorry about that. I apologize. We had an extensive, I think, conversation on the floor that took us a little bit longer than what we expected, but nevertheless, I had a bill that I had to hear in public safety. So here we are. First one. Today we're going to talk, about three or four different bills. The first one is Senate File 2206, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator John Carlson, District 4. Senate File 2206 is a resolution to the President and to Congress to take some action, and I would just like to read that, if that would be all right, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, go ahead.
Whereas Minnesota has over 10,000 lakes and almost 70,000 miles of rivers and streams that are interconnected, and whereas sport fishing in Minnesota is estimated to support 43,000 Minnesota jobs to generate $2,800,000,000 annually in direct retail expenditures and to have an economic impact exceeding $4.7 billion per year. And whereas recent analysis has found DNA from Asian carp in major rivers in Minnesota, and whereas Asian carp in Minnesota lakes, rivers, and streams would threaten Minnesota's extensive aquatic ecosystem, and whereas the presence of Asian carp would be devastating to sport fishing and tourism in the state, now therefore be it resolved by the legislature of the state of Minnesota that it urges the President and the Congress of the United States to direct the United States Army Corps of Engineers to expedite permits and other review documents required to construct effective fish deterrent systems in and around Upper St. Anthony Lock and Dam and Lock and Dam numbers 1, 2, and 19 during 2012. Be it further resolved that the Congress is urged to appropriate federal money to fund installation of deterrence in Lock number 19 and to match Minnesota funds in placing deterrence in and around the other three locks. Be it further resolved that the Congress is urged to appropriate $10 million to fund research efforts coordinated between federal, educational, and private research facilities to stop and control Asian carp over the long term. Be it further resolved that the Congress is urged to appropriate funding to implement the National Asian Carp Plan and provide authority for the National Asian Carp Director to coordinate all federal efforts to control Asian carp. Be it further resolved that the Secretary of State of the State of Minnesota is directed to prepare copies of this memorial and transmit them to the President of the United States, the President and the Secretary of the United States Senate, and the Speaker and the Clerk of the United States House of Representatives, and Minnesota Senators and Representatives in Congress.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions so far from the committee? You also have somebody to testify, I believe, on in support of it. Mr. Diamond, is he present? And at the same time, would Mr. Botzek come forward? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Tom Diamond. Just want to quickly say how important this bill is and the next bill. As you know, the devastating impacts to our environment, our lakes, our rivers, our streams, and our waterways, if we don't do something about this Asian carp. And one of the things that I think is really important to point out about this first one is that in a lot of the discussion so far, it's been about protecting the river from the Twin Cities up, and we haven't had anything for the St. Croix and the lower part of the Mississippi. And this calls for consideration of a barrier at Lock 19, which I think is really important that we protect, do everything we can to protect the whole state. And the other piece to this and the next bill that I think is really important to emphasize is the research, because as you know, there's been a lot of proposals and how to best address this issue. And having an informed discussion is really important. But I must commend you that unlike other states where that informed discussion has prevented, created gridlock, and now action, that this is moving ahead with alternative different proposals, but at the same time trying to educate everybody as to the best way as we move forward. So thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Mr. Botzek, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Gary Botzek for the Minnesota Conservation Federation. And we are a part of a big carp coalition, better known as CC, but conservation and environmental groups working on this issue. And it's kind of an outgrowth of the AIS group that continues to work on all aquatic invasive species. Carp big problem. It's going to be a week tomorrow that the fishermen, the commercial fishermen down in Winona, saying in the same net, an adult big head, a grass carp and a silver carp, the so-called flying devils. I thought flying Luendas were bad, but now we've got flying silver carp. We know that problem, and it's here in Minnesota. And we would like to, again, echo what Mr. Diamond said. We support this legislation. The coalition's been working in three areas. One is federal legislation, and you couldn't miss it, but legislation was introduced in Congress, House and the Senate this week, by Senator Klobuchar, Franken. Ellison took the lead in the House, but Representative Paulson and Walz have signed on as original authors into legislation designed to fight the spread of Asian carp from the federal perspective. The second prong in our platform is state legislation, and I'd like to thank Senator Engelbrechtson for his leadership as we're bringing forward deterrent barrier strategies in bonding bills and in policy changes and a number of other areas this year. So we're going to see action from the state level and as far as electronic barriers being hung on some of these locks and dams, and we need to do that. And here's the reason why. Navigation season is going to open up in Minnesota in less than a month before the Twins open, and that's not good. We had hoped that we would have something to hang our hats on, or at least to hang electronic barriers on, before navigation season reopened, and that's not going to be the case. And here we go. Those carp that are in Winona last Friday will be free to start moving further north and join their brothers and sisters, and that's not a good sign for our fisheries to the north. And you heard the statistics from Senator Carlson in the resolution. Those are staggering numbers. Tourism is second only to agriculture in Minnesota as far as impact on the economy. We need to protect and enhance that. That's what the legacy amendment was all about. This is a major attack, and I appreciate this resolution to jumpstart the Congress, which is always a necessary thing to do. But we thank thank Klobuchar and Ellison for taking the lead on legislation, and we will work with the legislature to finish the work here. And one key point, in Keokuk, Iowa, the lock and dam 19 was mentioned by Mr. Diamond, and I want to echo that by closing St. Anthony Falls, that takes care of the Mississippi River, that takes care of Coon Rapids and Mississippi, or points north, but doesn't do a thing for the Minnesota River. Doesn't do a thing for the St. Croix River. So we need to look at defensive strategies south. I always like to do the analogy of Civil War. The more battles we can fight to the south, the better off we're going to be. So let's work, and that's why Keokuk, Iowa, lock and dam number 19 is the key one for the federal people to be looking at. And we think with the legislation that was introduced in Congress this week, we will begin those discussions. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll close and take any questions if there are any.
Thank you. Any questions from the members? Well, thank you, Mr. Botzik, for your support on this obvious, well-needed endeavor here that we've been talking about now for the last 2 years, and hopefully this will certainly help here get the federal folks involved. In fact, they already are. We just recently watched that in the news. Mr. Arnosti, is he here?
Just a quick question. Is there a national Asian carp plan and director already, or is this something where it's kind of sounds like they're already there, but I'm not sure. I hadn't heard of it, but
Mr. Chair and Senator John Goss is the carp czar. He's a CC also. He is working out of the White House. And as far as a plan, I'm not sure if there's a national plan, but there certainly is a plan for the Great Lakes, where most of the emphasis has been on. And the president just in his new budget just announced multi-million dollars back to the Great Lakes effort, the Chicago River, et cetera. You've been reading about that. We'd like to see some of that money diverted to this effort, but that's going to be a tough thing. But John Goss is his name, and he's the czar of the carp movement.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Botzik. If Don Arnosti's not here, I have one more testifier, Ms. Lee. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and also head the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. So you know our interest in this area is more than or goes beyond the housing issues, but it does affect our work in the housing. As we provide affordable housing to low-income people and do a number of developments, we're also working on several job plans to help put Minnesotans back to work and a number of other efforts in healthcare and many other fields that Minnesota needs. The reason I'm here is because we have had feedback related to the use of the term Asian in Asian CARP. We did some investigation into, and we previously sent you some information as to our research on where did the name Asian CARP come from. We were told that it was from Asia, and our information showed that it came from the Amur River that borders China and Russia. And Russia is not Asia. And a lot of Asian countries, or countries you call Asia, don't know the fish. And this is the first time they heard of it. We do understand it is a food fish. It was imported to Arkansas and some other states to help with the filter and the plankton, and also with the locks and dams and valves and so forth for as far as cleaning them. So besides being a food fish, it has been utilized. I think it got out of hand with the floods when Arkansas let some of the fish loose in the river, and it made its way upstream. However, we also found out that the grass carp is from Mexico. The ones that were in Arkansas were sterilized, so they cannot reproduce. And so our effort here was to try and stem the tide as far as the racism and all the attacks made against the Asian people in the Asian country. Right now, there are multi-billion dollars as far as Minnesota businesses doing business with Asian countries, and they are very familiar with, or they're very sensitive to, how they're perceived, just as Americans are sensitive to how they're perceived in European countries and in Asian countries. If I didn't introduce myself, I also wanted to say that besides CARP not being Asian, that I am also not from Asia, although I've been called Asian, and I am not an invasive species, although I've been called that. Species is a movie about a half Martian and half human, and so as far as being affiliated with any of these terms, it has worked against the population, and also there is no Asian invasion, although from what I heard in the testimony earlier, they're talking about the fish and not the people. And so we would like to have this clarified. I did have a short discussion with Professor Sorensen, and he believes if we stick to the terms that it was normally or that these fish were normally referred to, as far as the big head, the silver, the black, and the grass carp, that these are appropriate terms. They also have scientific terms, which I had earlier given you. Now, the other thing is we made contact with General Mills. They're willing to help with the issues as far as processing the fish, because we said with all the people in need of food and all the other states who are shipping the food or the carp that they catch over to other countries, that this is something we could get involved to, too, other than just using electric nets, and that's the end of it. So we are hoping that this committee and the people who are involved in the locks and dams will look at how we can further utilize the fish and process it, as there is also an Australian processor coming into town from New Zealand. They also don't want to be called Asian, and they already have fishermen lined up to catch the fish. There's also the Managua fisheries in Renville, And there's a farmers unit industry in Redwood Falls and Long Prairie who can also process some of the products from the fish. I'm not sure the status of Fisher Fisheries who could do it. So I'm asking that this committee look beyond just the idea as far as let's do something about these bad fish, and also to drop the name Asian to its more appropriate term. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any members, any questions? I must tell you that Ms. Lee, we came into my office about a month and a half ago and voiced her concerns about this, and I certainly understand. I certainly understand, but I also need to make it very clear. At least I hope nobody that's been dealing with the invasive carp issue has referred to any of your descendants as being invasive. I shouldn't probably have to ask that on record or anything, but. We certainly mean in this committee no malice or anything derogatory towards that, and I hope that hasn't happened. But I will tell you that at the national level, it has been called that as well. And
yes,
as you know, we also did have a discussion about minnow. I mean, it is a legal term, I believe, minnow. And I expressed, I think, at that time to you that for me to move forward with these types of expenditures and this type of information when the whole state of Minnesota has been somewhat, if you will, publicly geared towards invasive species, invasive carp, and yes, sometimes it's called Asian carp, it would be really hard, or at least it seems to me very hard to call this invasive minnow legislation, with all due respect, it would be very hard for the public to understand, wait a minute, what happened here? So we did have that discussion, and I certainly understand that. I don't know if you did have conversation with the commissioner or not, Commissioner Landwehr. I think that's where you and I ended it, our discussion that day. I don't know if he has any means to make that happen. But again, at the national level, it's being called that. The immediacy to move forward, I think, I certainly would not like it to stop. I don't think you would either. I don't think that's your intention here today.
No.
But your intention is to stop calling it Asian. And I'm not sure that I or this committee could do that,
Mr. Chair,
in this quick a time. So,
Mr. Chair, I think if you just drop the name Asian, just call it aquatic invasive species of fish or invasive carp, that would better fit. We are working at the national level to have it changed. President Obama's sister is Asian, so I think he'd be concerned about how she would be called, too. So we do have contacts that we're working with there. And I think it is more damaging than the name changes that had occurred when they were dealing with names being called or the use of the sports teams, I think. What was it? The Redskins, the Sioux, and all these others. So I think if we could find an appropriate name, we could push it forward if the committee will help. And I did send information to the commissioner, and we haven't heard back from him or his staff, who was also informed. And we have made contact with the governor's office, and we're waiting to hear, too. So they are aware of the issue. It's just that, as they say, nobody can agree on the term. On your second page of the handout was a list of possible names that people have been throwing out. But I think more simply is what Professor Sorensen said, is it's really been called the big head, the black carp, and the silver carp, and why not leave it at that? And in legislation, when you talk about the grouse, you have specifically named grouse by name of very detailed, this grouse, that grouse, or whatever, and some of the other type of fish, like I think there was a I've never heard of the fish before, but there was a list of different kinds of fish where you have specifically named fish. So these are only four fish we're talking about to properly name them. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 2206 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor of the Senate.
So that would be sent to the Rules Committee.
To the Rules Committee. Thank you.
Senator Carlson moves Senate File 2206 to be passed and moved to the Rules Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Next, Senator Carlson, Senate File 2264.
Mr. Chair, again for the record, Senator John Carlson, Senate District 4. Senate File 2264 does a number of things. In Section 1, we are appropriating $4.2 million from the Clean Water Fund to Bowser for the local projects. That's kind of a regular basis. I'm not sure what the amount was last year, but anyway, we have some expert testimonies to talk about that. That's Section 1. Section 2 is the appropriation, again, from the Clean Water Fund of $1.8 million to fund the research center at the University of Minnesota for aquatic invasive and species research. Article... Section 2, still, we're requesting a reprioritization of $1 million from the trust fund, the LCCMR, of $1 million to be reprioritized to the research center at the University of Minnesota. And finally, the appropriation of $1 million in a bonding bill for appropriate facility upgrades at the University of Minnesota so that they can get this research center underway. So basically, members, this is about establishing the research center at the University of Minnesota, basically maybe probably a one-of-its-kind at a public university research center focused on how do we eliminate some of these aquatic invasive species, whether it's Eurasian milfoil, whether it's a silver carp, whether it is the zebra mussels, whatever they are. What I'd like to do is, I'm not sure what order you have, but Dr. Peter Sorensen is here from the university to talk a little bit about that. Would that be appropriate to have
Dr. Sorensen
at this time?
That would be fine. Welcome. Yep, that'd be great. Is everything mechanically hooked up and ready to go over there?
Do we have something to do here?
Becky?
No.
He's panicking now. Hit the on button.
Nowhere to sit. You know.
Thanks, Becky.
Bert. While you're waiting, maybe we should deal with the delete all amendment, Senator Carlson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Get that. The A3 delete all amendment.
Has been handed out.
Basically, what the A3 delete all amendment does is it changes a couple of words that helps make it easier for Bowser in the. And I think Mr.
Jaski.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Jaski. Yeah, Jaski. Mr. Jaski could maybe speak to.
Mr. Jaski, could you come forward and speak to the amendment, please, before we pass it? It's an author's amendment. I guess we'll go ahead and move the amendment right now. So Senator Carlson offers the delete all amendment to Senate File 2246. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. All right. Mr. Jaski, to the amendment.
Chairman John Jaski, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. Senator Carlson said... we had proposed that not changing the intent or the funding amount, but restructuring the language for the appropriations to line up with the appropriations that were made in legislation last year. It just helps us be consistent with the way we track the funds and use the state systems to measure and track and report on all the results of the projects that are going to be funded with this fund, with these funds. So I wanted to make sure you understood that it wasn't a change in intent, but a change in structure and similar to what we've done in previous years. There are a couple of modest changes to language that I can highlight. First one is on page 2. These, again, I should point out, the Clean Water Council did meet not long ago, a week or so, and they made recommendations very similar to this. There's one that they a little bit different than their recommendation. That's the one on page 2 on line 2.4 through 2.8. We have the responsibility to track the results of these projects, and we have a bid that was currently completed for this project, and it was it budgeted $300,000. It's a $600 and some thousand dollar project, and so they're proposing that difference be covered by this adjustment to the appropriation to develop this system to track and measure the conservation projects that are being built by local governments. Here, the page 2 on line 2.27 of the amendment, we got some input from the drainage work group and the Natural Resources Conservation Service that flexibility in the kinds of projects that would be eligible for the conservation drainage practices should include projects that are not only those that are already in existence, but those that are being installed currently. So that would change it to allow them to be eligible for this cost share funding. And you can see at the bottom of page 2, it would leverage federal money. It's also anticipated. And then on page 3, we have funding that's been appropriated for vulnerable wellhead areas, drinking water areas. And the current designation of these wellhead areas is defined in statute, and Department of Health coordinates that. There are some areas in southeastern Minnesota that are explicitly defined here that don't have that similar designation and similar ability to be protected then. So they have suggested, along with the local governments, that we add this language specifically for that area in southeastern Minnesota that has vulnerable groundwater contamination issues and tied to this unique geology that they have in that area. So that's, Mr. Chairman, the parts of the delete all amendment for that section, section 1, the only part that affects our agency.
Members, any questions? Senator Keilat.
Yeah, just are we moving funds from one thing to another here, and what are we leaving behind?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Keilat, maybe staff can comment on that. Mr. Mueller probably can cover it better than I can.
But Mr. Mueller can handle it.
Or for purpose, I guess, is maybe the better way to put it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Keilat, no, we are appropriating an additional to Bowser, $4.2 million from the Clean Water Fund on top of what was appropriated last year.
Okay.
Just quickly, the February fund or February forecast had a fund balance for the Clean Water Fund of about $9.8 million, which was about 11%. So this bill is appropriating about $6 million of new clean water money, which would bring that fund balance down to just a little bit less than 4%, which is about even to what we're doing with the other funds. So there was some money returned from previous biennium, and it's a little bit of growth in the revenue in the fund. So this bill is appropriating an extra $6 million.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions from Mr. Jasky? Hearing none. Dr. Sorensen, welcome.
Oh, well.
We'll go ahead with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me down here. I represent a group at the university that believes that some progress can be made to get the invasive species situation at least under control using some good science. And some of you have already heard some of this presentation before, so I apologize, but there's also some new material here. So I'm going to talk today then about an idea to create an aquatic invasive species research center at the University of Minnesota. It would be one of the only ones, frankly, in the country, and it would put us in a position where we could be proactive addressing these issues. Today I'll just talk very briefly about some definitions, which I suppose is redundant for a lot of people. The problem, which probably you're pretty much aware of, but maybe I can shed a little light on it from a scientific perspective, and then the most of it, I'll talk about the concepts behind a possible aquatic invasive species research center at the university, its goals and its approaches, and then we should have some time for questions. And if you want to interrupt me at any time, please do. I'm not sensitive about those things. Invasive species is an alien or introduced species that is doing economic or ecological harm to a local environment. That's really all it is. And sea lamprey is a perfect example of that. Everybody knows what that is. But the problem has gotten more recent, more complex lately because of these invasive species that are what this term might be new to you, but it might help a little bit. They're acting as ecosystem engineers, and they are modifying, creating, and destroying habitat that they occupy. And the common carp, zebra mussel, and Asian carp are all perfect examples of ecosystem engineers that really have dramatic effects in the whole ecosystem that they live in, from habitat to water quality. So it doesn't neatly pigeonhole in any particular committee necessarily. It's just overall degradation, and along with that goes problems with natural heritage and lifestyles in the state of Minnesota. And it's wonderful people are so concerned about this. Minnesota is in an interesting position. We're at the headwaters of the Mississippi, and also we have butt on the Great Lakes. We're the headwaters of the Mississippi. Frankly, we've been fortunate because we're one of the last states in the country really to be facing this massive onslaught of these things, and there's still time to do something. Seems it's not too late. I guess that's my point. But the threat is very real. There's a lot of things coming from the Mississippi, and I guess I want to point out that the Mississippi is really the problem here to a large extent because efforts in the Mississippi, particularly with respect to carps, have been grossly underfunded and underestimated. The Great Lakes is relatively well taken care of in contrast. There are problems with interconnectedness, barge and commercial traffic, recreation, you know it. The waterways are connected. Water flows, and you can't see things in it. It's a very difficult situation, and there are over 180 species of invasives in the Great Lakes, almost as many in the Mississippi, and a lot of those are headed towards us. But the history goes back actually over 100 years to the common carp, and this is part of the answer to the problem with the names. I know scientists solve the issue with the names using Latin names, so the common carp, Cyprinus carpio, it's a very specific term. This fish was stocked here in the 1870s by the government. It's a Eurasian river fish. My lab works on it now. It very quickly overwhelmed the country, and hundreds of thousands of acres have been destroyed by it. And it's an ecosystem engineer. More recently, Hypthomyces species, the quote-unquote Asian carps, have been threatening us. They're coming from the south. Introduced originally in 1970s. We can talk about more of this later. They're planktivorous. They're ecosystem engineers again. They're changing whole food webs, interfering with all aspects of aquatic life and human life south of us, destroying habitat. There are no practical means, as you all aware, of really doing anything other than perhaps delaying them, and that's a hard task. Even measuring them is difficult, but this is characteristic of things that live in water in general anyway.
Doctor, can you tell me where that photo was taken?
That photo? I'm pretty sure it was taken from the Illinois River, which is kind of a really... down there, they're estimated, and it's just an estimate, to be maybe about 75% of the biomass of the fish in the river down there. And there's actually signs that they're starting to starve to death. There are so many. I've seen that situation myself.
On a positive note, then. Thanks.
Yeah. So it's nothing like that here. We don't want it to get like this. So then, of course, the zebra mussel you're all well aware of, which was introduced through ballast water introduction to the Great Lake and ironically got into the Mississippi River and up to Minnesota through the Chicago Ship Canal, where these barriers are now being constructed. Another ecosystem engineer and probably well familiar. It clogs pipes and it removes plankton from the water. It greatly disrupts overall quality of life for aquatic organisms and then people trying to enjoy the waterways. And the issue is not just these. From my perspective, I've been studying invasive species since I arrived in Minnesota just over 20 years ago. It's the ones we know are on the way because they're in the water to the south of us and they're in the Great Lakes. So this includes the snakehead and the quagga mussel and things like hydrilia. So there's unfortunately more, and that's just the state of the situation. They're there. So we want to just get beyond that, beyond the reactive phase and the proactive stage. And I look at this and I say, what can you learn from this, this situation? One is this is a battle. It's been going on really since the late 1800s, a long time. Stakes are extremely high. Common carp have done enormous damage to the state of Minnesota. We're just not aware of it. Your great-great-grandparents, if they were living here, would have been aware of it. They would have seen it happen. Conventional approaches simply don't work to control these things. They're hard to sample, hard to find. There are no good specific poisons. There's not much available. And it's hard to do, particularly because you can't even see what you're working with. So this is kind of what I've learned. And looking at this, though, there are a few success stories, and there are a couple lessons that can be taken from it. One is the sea lamprey, with which I worked for about 15 years in the Great Lakes. The sea lamprey is an ancient species of fish that got into the Great Lakes, again, through a canal system, through a waterway. And it is parasitic, and it basically got into the Great Lakes in the early 1900s. And some of you may be aware, but by the 1940s, it had almost destroyed every single fish in the Great Lakes, causing massive government panic. It's kind of and what happened? People started doing just what we're thinking about now with Asian carp. Initially, people started building barriers. They started fishing them out. And horses started getting electrocuted and things like that in these barriers. I have a picture of one here. There's still a few around. None of it particularly worked very well. So the U.S. and Canadian government got together and they formed a scientific group called the Great Lakes Fishery Commission that still exists today, started a basic research program. Frankly, it's been suggested kind of like a moonshot. And they decided they were just going to work at this until they figured it out. They started screening chemicals to find if there was a toxin that would control the sea lamprey. It took them 5 years and over 6,000 chemicals later, they finally hit on one, trifluoromethyl-4-nitrophenol, TFM, which is still the basis of sea lamprey control today, although they're enlarging it. But it started out as just a basic approach, a long-range perspective, and just the optimism that something could be resolved. And today, sea lamprey are about 90% controlled in the Great Lakes. Not perfect, but there's fisheries in the Great Lakes, and Lake Superior was actually saved. It's the only lake that wasn't completely wrecked, and the fish have come back. We've also had some success with common carp in the state of Minnesota. We started when I left my lamprey work in 2005 with the help of the LCCMR. We started working on common carp. This was after my experience with sea lamprey and seeing some work in the southern hemisphere. And we decided that there had to be some weakness in this life history of this common carp we could get at. It's kind of a long story, but it took us 5 years before we really started getting a handle on it. But we just started systematically working through its life history. We found that nobody knew how old they were here, how many young they had, where they swam. People really didn't know much about them. Just like, frankly, we don't really know a lot in detail about zebra mussel and Asian carps today, or silver carp, not in detail. And, that particular slide didn't work, but I knew one didn't. I don't know why. But what we found was that these common carp moved to outlying degraded areas in the ecosystems where they young often survive because those areas are degraded from game fish, and that we could remove them and then actually repopulate, restore outlying degraded wetlands for game fish populations, and the common carp could come under control. Wasn't a result we necessarily expected, but it was something we started just working through with the scientific process. So the lessons I take, there are just a few examples here, but that knowledge is empowering. Understanding these things is absolutely essential. Every species has its weakness. Most of these, both of those things, the sea lamprey and common carp, are not invasive in their home habitats, as a matter of fact. Common carp are even stocked in Europe at the present time. And Atlantic sea lamprey are endangered. So there's natural control systems out there. We just have to go out and find them. These weaknesses, however, might be unexpected. It's something that a thorough scientific investigation might take, and it may take some time. So the way forward is really that you have to know what you're dealing with really, really well, inside and out. The better you know it, the more likely you are to be successful. And it may not be expected. It may not be something necessarily that, I learned as an undergraduate 30 years ago. It's going to be something different. There are alien species. And once you get that, you can start to look at ways to prevent its introduction. But I would say as you do that, you should be looking at ways simultaneously to delay that invasion. And as you look at ways to delay their invasion, this is where we are with the silver carp right now with barriers, we should be thinking about what's the next step, because we know none of these barriers are 100%. So let's not wait to realize the weaknesses in our methods. Let's be proactive and work at several levels. this, frankly, is pretty much how human medicine works. I kind of view invasive species almost like a cancer of the environment. Many tools are needed. And as we work to delay the invasion, we should be looking at ways to target and reduce numbers. Targeting is really key, and maybe eventually ways to eradicate. So as I look at the center here, the idea would be to hit all those key elements and take proactive movement and start to look at ways so that maybe 5 to 10 years, we can get at least a handle on some of these things and work with the DNR and other local government agencies to control them and give people some room and hope for some improvement rather than this constant defensive delay mode. So this research center would be, I would hope and expect, to be working intimately with the DNR and other local, federal, state research agencies and perhaps watershed districts. The strength of the university is research, particularly in the lab, not necessarily applied research, and the DNR and other groups have lots of interest and experience with that. So we have to work together, everyone. So that I just want to be really clear about that.
Doctor, you have certainly worked with the DNR before with the CARP research that you've done?
Yes, we work with both West and East Metro fish management groups with common carp.
Thank you.
Quite successfully, and I enjoy that. And we've learned a lot from them, actually. So, so the objectives then of this center that we're proposing would be to develop new, reliable, and useful monitoring programs. New, I stress the word new and reliable. I'll talk about it in a little detail in a second, but that's one of the key right now is with the silver carp. We don't really know where they are, and by the time the results come back from Indiana where the eDNA samples are being sent out a couple months later, it's too hard to react and very confusing, and it's just difficult to deal with. We want to develop some new deterrence techniques that are scientifically based and published in peer-reviewed literature, so it's available, not necessarily from a private company, which has, whose information is not necessarily publicly available. We want to work on new control strategies and, importantly, eradication strategies. And we want to assist the DNR in implementing a lot of these things. So I'll just quickly go through this because I don't want to take too much of your time. But we want to develop new molecular tests. We don't want to just repeat or replace what's being done already. We want to try something, some new things. This would be a new faculty line at the university, addressing things of immediate local concern, and do this in ways that are a lot more efficient and quickly. So if we, this is a little map here of the presence of silver carp, hypothetical of the presence of DNA up the St. Croix River, so that we could get results, turn them around quickly, and do experiments in the lab and repeat and understand, and people would come visit us, and we could interpret the results. So move forward like that. So the state would be directly involved in collecting this critical information in a timely and thoughtful way, and in ways that hopefully move the field forward. We're also particularly interested in new deterrence techniques. I've been working on this for a while, particularly bubble barrier systems, because I think there's a lot of potential to target sound systems in carps. But as you know, there's only one company based in the UK that really produced these stuff, and it was designed actually for marine power plants, not for local species, not necessarily for silver carp. We think there's a lot of room to move that field forward, particularly for things like was brought up, what about large rivers? Maybe we can develop deterrent systems for like the Minnesota River or small tributaries. We're putting one in now just north of St. Paul, actually. That would be custom fit for local situations.
Doctor, 1 second.
Yes.
Senator Scoy has a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
And Doctor, I'm really sorry to interrupt you in your presentation.
No problem.
I have a bill coming up that I'm going to need to leave for, and I have a question. Maybe Senator Carlson, probably, or DNR. On page 6 of the bill, under the aquatic invasive species provision, I see we're taking $1 million from the 2013 aquatic invasive species, our effort to delay this invasion. And I'm strongly supportive of this research. I mean, I think we have to do it absolutely in the most urgent manner. But I'm also concerned about taking the money from our effort to delay the invasion. And as in your putting this together, I assume you're trying to balance this out. But Has anybody looked at that, and what is the DNR thinking about what they're going to do with $1 million less, and how is all this going to play out when we've got that reduction for 2013? Are you tracking with me, Senator Carlson, what I'm concerned with?
Right.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Scoy. The challenge, of course, is how do we fund this center? And I think that I think we've all recognized from all the testimony we've heard all session that we're not going to stop this with current deterrent methods. And all of our best efforts are not going to stop it. At best, we can slow these things down, whether it's the zebra mussel, the silver carp, whatever it is. Without this quality research going into place so that we can really study it on that kind of a level that Dr. Sorensen and his colleagues can do, all of our best efforts at deterrent just aren't going to matter. And so I think in that vein, it's a hard decision, but I think it's the right decision to say we really have got to jumpstart this research center, and the best way we could think of to do that, if you look at the appropriations, excuse me, in the first year the appropriations 2,177,000, and the next year. It would still go up. It would still be an increase from the $2,177,000 up to $2,513,000. So there still would be an increase in appropriations for that, but at the same time taking that extra $1 million and putting into the research where we know it's going to have probably the best bang for our buck long term.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Carlson. Well, I'm supporting your research effort here, but I think in the next week or so, until this gets to the floor, whenever it does, we should see if there isn't some mechanisms that we can utilize to leave this delay invasion effort fully funded too. And if there is, if there isn't, we'll have to try to work through that. But I do have a little concern there, and I appreciate your letting me interrupt because I do have to leave. I've got to go up in jobs committee.
Thank you. Senator Carlson, quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scoy, thank you for bringing that up because if we can find another way to get that million, I think all of us would be appreciative of being able to leave that if we can. And so if we can put our best efforts forward to finding another way to get it, I think that would be good too. I thank you.
Okay, thanks. Dr. Sorensen.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate the concern, too. Both are very important. So it's the point, how do you achieve the balance, and how much money does the university optimally need to phase in? And I guess I would say I'm very flexible and reasonable about that. So have a discussion about that,
Senator,
certainly.
Senator Higgins.
Before Senator Scoy leaves, I just wanted to remind him that LCCMR has its RFP out right now. And at the last meeting, we decided that we would put a significant amount of the next round of funding toward invasive species as well.
So maybe some of that could offset some of this.
Yeah, except it doesn't come in time.
Thank you. Good. Thank you.
If I may, I would just comment on the LCCMR really briefly. Frankly, what we really need is a long-term, concerted, systematic effort. So it's great to have a lot of money up front. It's essential. But I'm very interested in how we're going to keep this process going and, ramp up to speed, because what the university needs is not sort of more of the same. We need new and better. We need to get new faculty members here, recruit them, offer them a career, and make worth people's while to really, devote their lives to figuring out how to solve this. And that's what's needed. Anyway, I guess maybe that's appropriate because that's what the nature of control techniques are. And I've hypothetically broken this up into sort of three areas. One is not an area that I necessarily have expertise in, but it's a perfect example of I think the sort of crisis scenario we're in now. I mean, I think people are afraid because they just don't know what to do. I have great faith. I guess I'm a scientist, but I have great faith that there are weaknesses in the genetics, physiology, nutrition. There's something, a weakness in zebra mussel because they're not necessarily invasive in their home habitat. And I'd like to bring a faculty line and support staff and a new lab to the University of Minnesota, start as soon as possible to look for the Keeley's heel and the weakness in this species. And this would be a whole new venture, and we would need a promise of some long-term support to get somebody good that really, like, you know, someone's going to devote their lives or a significant portion of their lives to this. Because it's not a trivial thing. Second would be somebody, actually I have somebody like this now at the university to work on invasive fish ecology. He's spent now 6 or 7 years with us. We have real expertise here. I don't want to lose this guy. I want to keep him here. I think we have one of the best teams around, and we want to give him more support and a promise of a career and a faculty line of his own so that we can really get to the nitty-gritty of why there are so many silver carp and what the weaknesses are. We also want to pursue their behavior. We found that one of the weaknesses of the behavior of the common carp is their tendency to aggregate in the winter. And if we could mimic those conditions, it might just be certain levels of light, for instance, under the ice. If we could mimic that, we could have a very efficient trapping device and that could start to remove them. We also find that one of the weaknesses is that their eggs are extremely susceptible to predation. We need systematic studies. I suspect the same could just be true of the silver carp, as a matter of fact. They have a lot of similarities in their life history. They're long-lived. They have to be 20, 40, 50 years old, and they have millions of eggs each year. Obviously, most of those eggs don't make it. It's important to find out why not and to see if we can enhance that process. So we want to start looking at that from a long-term perspective. And also, invasive plants. That isn't so new, but that's a big issue. I work in a lot of lakes, and we want to look at some new, serious, long-term efforts to look at things like Eurasian milfoil, curly leaf pondweed, which came in with the common carp, look at some new long-term techniques. Dr. Newman at the university already does this. I'd like to offer him an opportunity instead of just doing it in two-year chunks, but to get really serious about it and spend the rest of his career focused on that. And then this is sort of even more, a little bit more what I guess you might call blue sky. But I spent considerable time working with a research group in Australia. And it's interesting there, they don't even bother with things like barriers. They just recognize that these things aren't going to work. So they're putting a lot of effort in down there into eradication techniques, particularly molecular engineering of fish and diseases, actually. And the Australians have a history of success with this. The rabbits got onto the continent of Australia about 40 years ago and decimated the place, and they were able to identify a virus that they released across Australia that has successfully controlled the rabbits ever since. There have been a couple ripples in it. And I think that although that's a little bit more risky, a little bit more futuristic, this is the potential silver bullet. And I would like to start up a research line on that at the university, working through the vet school, where they already have considerable expertise, actually, worldwide, identifying wildlife diseases. So in this case, turning it against some of these invasive species. And then we also would like to develop better systematic sampling protocols, particularly to help the DNR and people. These species are difficult to find, and it's difficult to understand their distributions. And some systematic effort by a PhD-level person, Paul Venturelli in this case, I think could be enormously beneficial because the sampling efforts are also extremely expensive. This eDNA, every single sample costs a few hundred dollars. You wonder if it's being optimally used. It's a statistical challenge, and it's worth looking at ways of optimization. And then lastly, we'd like to get this information out. And I would like to work. We're doing this with watersheds, but I'd like to get it really out there. I get a lot of calls already about common carp. We'd like to create a position and a few staff. And maybe some of these staff could even be DNR employees. I think that would be terrific. This is how the sea lamprey control program works. They have DNR and federal government staff embedded in the sea lamprey control program at Michigan State University. They work as a team, and they share information, and they develop technologies together. And this has worked for sea lamprey, and I think this would be a good model. And that's what I have in mind here. We need new solutions, and we need to get them out, not just keep them in academia. So that's kind of my overall scheme. I'm thinking it's going to take 1 to 3 years to start this up. Some things will start up faster than others, like common carp and milfoil, because we're doing it. Asian carp a little bit quicker, because we've already got some money from the federal government. We have some Asian carp work going on. But other things like the zebra mussels, definitely going to take a little bit. We're trying something that's very exciting. It's got enormous potential, but extremely challenging. We have to recruit and get some people here and build a new lab for them to get this going. When you look at the budget, this is the budget. You've probably seen some version of it. I assume the numbers that have been bantered around are based on this. We need about $2,000 to build new laboratories and, importantly, restore a rather dilapidated holding facility we have at the university so we can study these things and not be worried about them going down the drain to the Mississippi River. And I don't want to be responsible for that. And then, of course, we need just operating money for things like lab equipment and boats and things like that.
Senator Carlson.
So that's my presentation.
Senator Carlson, we just gained $1.8 million on his last comment.
Yeah,
he did say $2,000. I think you meant $2 million.
I did. Yeah. It all seems like a lot to me, to be honest with
that's
you.
Just
that's what I'm usually working with.
Now it's gone again. Yeah. Just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Solve your problem.
Okay. Any questions, members? Senator Kielash.
Yes. Senator Sorensen, Mr. Sorensen, okay. Professor Sorensen, we had a great conversation.
Don't demote him. Don't demote him.
In my office, and, you know.
He did.
Yeah, it's exciting, and what you're trying to do. And one of the things we talked about is, you know, it's great to have stuff at the lab, but getting it out into the field.
Right.
And also training the next generation of
Absolutely.
Biologists to get out
yep.
and be able to start working with the DNR and that. And I don't know if you could expand on whether or not this funding is going to enable you to do that. And could you also just talk about the center's ability to leverage with everything from park boards to watershed districts or lake associations, the not just the research but the deterrence and your ability to gather data?
Okay, well, that's sort of
Big,
I think our strength is we gather data and we keep it and we're systematic. And importantly, that's you know what we do. We try and publish it so it's publicly available and be scrutinized and understood. In terms of your question about, let's see, the other one was leveraging money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at this point, this center should be in a good particularly with things like zebra mussel and common carp in a good position to do that. Frankly, I've been largely self-supporting now for a few years, with the exception I've had some LCCMR money, but largely because a lot of lake associations, watersheds are kind of in crisis mode. They have very, very severe water quality issues, invasive plants, common carp, now zebra mussel. They don't know what to do. And they do have, as you know, some taxing authority, and they have some money. And we've been fortunate enough, and you know, it's been our honor, really, to work with several of these watersheds, and it's really allowed our work to go forward. So I would expect that should continue. Not all organizations, unfortunately, particularly outstate watersheds, it kind of breaks my heart sometimes. They really need help, but they don't have any money at all. So, you know, maybe this could help those folks, those citizens. But there is potential of leveraging money locally as well as through federal research grants. We have National Science Foundation money now to develop robotic tracking devices for carp. We have money from U.S. Geological Survey for looking at pheromones in Asian carp. So this kind of thing, I don't know. Dean Ponce de Leon is over there, but he can tell you how much money a faculty member typically brings in, but we usually more than pay for ourselves, I believe. At least I've been able to. So these things kind of, you get it going, you develop a national center for this, I would expect we'd have more than enough people willing and able to at least contribute and enhance this effort. Is that
Just to follow, one of the other things we talked about is you were talking about an accelerated
right.
PhD program for
right.
watershed biologists or whatever.
That would be really helpful.
Is that
Well, that's that would be great.
Or is that part of the plans, or is that?
It sort of isn't. That's why I didn't know what to do, so I put a plus mark there. Because I didn't want to change the numbers that I had submitted a couple months ago prior to talking with you. But after talking with you, I thought, well, yeah, that would be a great idea to enhance this extension and application part. So that part would have to be bumped up a little bit. Is that?
Yeah, I think that's that, to the point that we were looking
at. Yeah, yeah, and that's so I've been thinking about it, and what we could do is if anyone might remember, when I presented this to Lassard Sams, I just said one position. Now I'm saying, well, maybe two or three. Mm-hmm. And we could develop a team that would work with the DNR watersheds to go out and systematically sample some. There are special ways of sampling invasive fish. I mean, we've figured out how to do common carp. We'd have to figure out how to do silver carp. They're different. They jump. They're smart. They swim around. You know, you can't just use standard DNR gear. It's all designed for game fish. I mean, that was the issue until recently. So we'd work with those groups and develop. I'd have to develop like a unit within the university. It's not probably a traditional thing, but we could collect data at the same time and help some of the local lakes and watersheds and so forth. And maybe they could contribute to that.
And just to follow up, any idea the number of graduate students that, with the increase in faculty, that you'd be able to accommodate?
Well, I guess I've described three or four new faculty, so you might get, you know, half a dozen graduate students. And you're bringing up a great point, because, frankly, this is going to be one of the challenges of the center, is getting qualified people. There aren't a lot of people coming through the system now with qualifications in this area. It's a new area. The money's been really tight until recently, and it would be, I think, really smart. In fact, this research project I'm part of in Australia, they have two or three graduate student lines in there for that very reason. They want to get these students out, and this is what's happening with sea lamprey control, too. The sea lamprey control program just swallows up every single grad student that comes out of Michigan State through their PERM program that's being trained like that. And they're used for sea lamprey control. They have the special skills and pheromones and molecular techniques that traditional fisheries biologists, you know, weren't lucky enough to get.
So I guess the last question I have, I know that one of the issues about recruiting is the length of time that you can give them a contract. And while the funding goes out for a couple of years, what would, if we were to look at this a little longer range, what would you suggest that we need to do in order to attract the best and the brightest to come and commit to Minnesota, to this center?
Oh, that's kind of why I put 8 years up there. That's what I was thinking.
Okay.
Usually somebody comes up for tenure in 6 to 8 years. That would give a chance to somebody to establish themselves and develop a permanent place in the university in the state of Minnesota and a career in that area. Yeah. So that, like I said, that's really, really important. You're not going to get the best and brightest. It might be somebody who leaves biomedical industry or something, because that's the kind of expertise we need. They've got to see this as a real viable future.
Career path. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, members? Well, thank you very much for that presentation.
Well, thank you very much.
We appreciate the work you're doing and the work you've working with us to give us some an idea as to what to fund here. And hopefully we can move forward with these dollars and cents and start getting on this. It's real encouraging when I hear you say there's still time to do something, and that's certainly good. So appreciate it. Thank you very much. We have somebody from the Clean Water Council here, Jennifer Maletsky. Please help me with your name, please.
Maletsky.
Maletsky?
Oh, yep.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Maletsky. I'm the staff administrator for the Clean Water Council. Happy to be here today. As you know, on February 28th, the Clean Water Council submitted a recommendation for $6 million to fund Bowser programs, specifically for the Clean Water Assistance Grant Program. We're grateful for Senator Carlson to carry this bill. One of the council's top priorities is to maintain these programs that put on the ground projects to protect and improve the state's water bodies. Last year, the Board of Water and Soil Resources put out a request for proposals, and there was a 3-to-1 ratio of funds requested versus what was available. So the council really feels that providing this additional funding is great to get projects on the ground. They know that this funding disparity is always going to be there, but they're just happy to be able to have these additional funds appropriated at this time. The extra funding will also help to leverage additional funding from federal and local sources, because there's a lot of grant and matching programs with this money. As far as the delete all amendment, I was able to see this a little earlier today. Like I said, the council only recommended through its motion the extra $6 million for Section A, which is the Clean Water Assistance Program. The intention really was for on-the-ground projects, so they are fine with the amendment. Letters A, B, D, and F. They did not discuss making a recommendation for C, which is the oversight and accountability funding. And that's not to say they don't think it's important. They just didn't discuss it at their March meeting. So I wanted that to be on the record for you. And then turning to the AIS issue, we talked about it at great detail today. Millions of dollars has been spent to put in barriers to search across the country. The council understands the importance of this issue. They certainly understand the severity, and they want it to be addressed in Minnesota. They actually invited Dr. Sorensen to come to the council's Budget and Outcomes Committee in February and heard his presentation and were impressed with what he was proposing. The BOC also invited agency staff members to come and talk about AIS, and certainly from the Clean Water Council's perspective, they are interested in how AIS impacts water quality and how it affects water quality impairments. That's, you know, the Clean Water Fund is only supposed to be spent to protect, enhance, and restore water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams, and to protect groundwater from degradation. So at our meeting last week, the council members really, you know, had a heavy debate about, is this an appropriate use of clean water funding to address AIS issues? Again, they certainly think it's important, and they see the need for it. So they know that, you know, there's never going to be enough money to address all the natural resources issues and certainly water pollution issues in the state. We have this great source of long-term dedicated funding, and they've really determined that there's the need for the coordinated statewide approach for monitoring assessment, and then the strategy development, and then implementation. And that's the approach we've been using for the last several years. So ultimately, they did make the recommendation for $6 million for the non-point source implementation, with a caveat that they are well aware that AIS is a really big issue. So they recommended no more than 1.2 to be spent for the AIS Research Center as it relates to water quality impacts, and then $600,000 for AIS civic engagement and public education as it relates to water quality impacts. So I was happy to see in Dr. Sorensen's proposal that, you know, there's that information transference that he's talking about. The council had talked about possibly that money going to DNR to work with citizens through public education at boat launches, and primarily to talk about preventing the spread of AIS. Additionally, the council also discussed that AIS can be addressed through Bowser's grant programs. They feel that local watersheds could submit grant proposals to deal with AIS at that local level. So that's another thing that they've discussed. The council did want to make aware that their recommendation is meant to be one-time funding only for startup costs for these AIS issues. There's just so much other money out there, and, you know, the Clean Water Fund dollars certainly won't even begin to address all of the pollution program or pollution problems from non-point and point source. So they're really cautious in making this recommendation, and they feel that ongoing costs for the research center and other avenues should be used through funding like federal sources or LCCMR. So with that, questions?
I don't have any questions. Members, any questions? I certainly appreciate your consideration from the council to step up and help out with this. I mean, we're getting funding mechanisms from all over, and that certainly shows that everybody's concerned, I think. Any questions at all, members?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at page 7, the section 2. And the second sentence in there says that the appropriation is not subject to 116P.05 and blah, 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 which, if I understand correctly, is the work plan submission and approval by LCCMR. And we have worked with Professor Sorensen at LCCMR quite a long time, and I'm pretty confident that we can. How many syllables did I just put in confident? Way too many. Sorry. I'm pretty confident that we can do the work plan, in a very expedited manner, and not cause any delay. But this is a kind of a bad precedent to start with. LCCMR funds, the Environmental Trust Fund funds, and them not being looked over by LCCMR. And so I'm kind of concerned about this sentence and thinking that it could go away without much trouble.
And this is which line?
It starts on 7.24. The sentence that starts, this appropriation is not subject to. Deleting that one sentence, I believe, would...
And your concern is that the LCCMR, Senator Higgins, is going to be, being put on the hook yearly for this? Or is that
no,
the concern?
No, Mr. No. Sorry. Mr. Chair, sorry, I must not be clear. All of the projects that are funded by LCCMR go through a work plan and approval. And this sentence would say that this $1 million would not go through that process. And that's quite a departure from the Environmental Trust Fund funding process that we use. And I would like the sentence to be deleted from the bill. I think LCCMR, we're pretty good at looking at work plans. We have SMART with scientists. We have people in all areas who can look through these things. I think Dr. Sorensen would probably be fairly comfortable with us looking at the work plan, and I don't want to speak for him if he's still here. So,
Senator, maybe as a point of clarification, this money was redirected from the DNR that was given to the DNR by LCCMR. Does this sentence here cover that? Is that fair?
Well, Mr. Chair, this money, as you see on the previous page, was for aquatic invasive species to the DNR, and that's been reduced by $1 million, and you're reappropriating it here to the university. The money to the DNR last year also had an exemption from those provisions of the work plan and the approval.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, all of the kind of the legislative initiatives and burgeoning issues, and then the park money, all were exempted from those provisions in the special session bill. So it's basically this money was not going to be subject to a work plan and an approval requirement. And what this does is continue that this money will not be subject to those considerations.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Knopf, that was put in without. As far as I know, the LCCMR having any input in that. It was put in without this committee having any input in that. And it's a really bad precedent when the Environmental Trust Fund money just goes over there to the department, and it isn't being reviewed by the entity that we ourselves set up to do that review of.
But to understand, those dollars that were appropriated from LCCMR to get to that point were discussed by LCCMR, by the group, to the DNR.
Is that true?
That correct? To the DNR.
Is Ms. Thornton here?
Yes, she is.
She was here a bit ago.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Thornton, would you like to
come up?
Sure.
But I don't think we put in that provision.
Welcome to the committee.
No, it wasn't the commission. It was the legislature.
Mr. Chair, Susan Thornton with the LCCMR staff. And I believe, Mr. Chair, you were inquiring about whether the $5.6 million for aquatic invasive species to DNR was discussed by the LCCMR. Is that
the question you have, Senator Higgins?
It's not the question I have. It was it came through the original LCCMR bill that we dealt with last year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, the original $5.6 million did not come as a recommendation from the LCCMR to the legislature.
So
it was a change made by the legislature last session. And as Senator Higgins said, we work with Dr. Sorensen right now and anticipate also him coming forward with a new proposal in response to the RFP. So we would work to, with the work plan, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, those are accomplishment plans. Same thing in the Outdoor Heritage Council.
Now I understand exactly what you're talking about. I went, wasn't far enough back. Those appropriations were taken from the LCCMR appropriation without
approval from the LCCMR.
Well, they approved it, but it was without discussions or a plan, as you talk about where all dollars are expended. Yes, I understand that.
So, Mr. Chair,
I think it's fair to say, too, though, Senator Higgins, that, you know, those were, you know, I'm not going to sit here and repeat that those were tough times. We all know that. That was certainly not an easy task. The bottom line is moving forward here, you're concerned about the legislature coming over to LCCMR taking money without, similar to that again, is that what your concern is?
Mr. Chair, this sentence that I'm talking about is saying that there would be no LCCMR oversight on this money. No work plan, no approval. That's what you have in the bill. I'm saying that it is appropriate for LCCMR to have that oversight, like they do for all the rest of the LCCMR proposals that we
sure.
have.
Yeah. That's all. I guess I don't have okay. Certainly, we can certainly
Mr. Chair,
something in there.
I would like to move the deletion of the sentence that starts on 7.24. Starting with this appropriation, deleting 7.25 and deleting the rest of the sentence on 7.26 up to the word as a, or up to the new sentence that starts with as a condition.
Deleting
that one sentence.
What does that do to it?
Well, Mr. Chair, what that does to this is that it would mean that the university would have to have a work program submitted to the LCCMR for approval prior to spending the money.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, this has already been funded by the LCCMR, so I don't think it's a big deal that way. It just seems like, you know, it's not, I think Senator Higgins is right that we should allow that oversight, and it's probably because this is $1 million. It can be incorporated with the whatever other plan the RFP brings out. So it's probably a good idea to eliminate this. So
I agree, Senator Kielash and Higgins. I don't think it's a big deal. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would consider that a friendly amendment. I think if we're going to be going back and hopefully maybe getting some more money from the LCCMR in the future, I think it's very appropriate that they have some oversight, and so I would consider that a friendly amendment.
I think that certainly, you know, certainly sends a message of the good work that you do over at LCCMR, and they shouldn't just be fully disregarded. So that's fine. I have no problem with that at all. Senator Higgins renews her motion for an oral amendment. And that amendment starts on line 724, the word delete from the word this to all the way through to section to line 126 at the subdivision 4 period. It ends there. Does everybody understand that? Mm-hmm. To Senator Higgins' motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Good. Thank you.
We have one more testifier, Lance Ness.
Oh, so they're still carrying on.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lance Ness. I'm going to change hats here a little bit and put on my Anglers for Habitat hat. I'm a president of that group as well. Of course, AIS is one of our top subjects at Anglers for Habitat, and we encourage and thank the senator for coming forward with this research study. Our group went down and took a tour of the USGS facility down in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and they're one of the leading federal research centers that are studying AIS, both carp and exotic species, and state-of-the-art facility here. And we would hope that we would get something very similar here in Minnesota to help study these aquatic invasive species here. Just want to talk about a couple things, research and silver bullets. Research is how we're going to solve this problem. We can do a lot of education about the cleaning of the boats and the stopping of the transfer of milfoil and zebra mussels, but at some point we've got to find some way to eradicate these things, and research, again, is going to get us there. I think there are some very promising points coming, ways to develop diseases for zebra mussels, and they have a thing down there called the bait bullet that they want to feed these carp, and hopefully they will change their pheromones in their eggs and make them attractive to our fish, so our fish will actually eat their eggs. It will hope to control them, not eradicate them. But it's one of the methods they're looking at and researching down there at the USGS facility. Finally, of course, we're concerned about the cost of all this. And I just want to make a note here that the last two zebra mussel infestations were from dockage, not from boat transfers. And maybe we ought to start looking at maybe some type of fee or surcharge on dockages when they're sold to help fund this further down the line, because you're going to need some source of long-term funding. We already have the boat fees, as you know, that are going to go towards AIS, so we need to look at some other forms of funding. And finally, I just want to mention I was president of the Minnesota Waterfowl Association back in the 1980s, and we put an electric barrier in Heron Lake. That barrier is still in existence today, and to my knowledge, no carp has ever breached that barrier. So there's a proof positive, if you will, of an example of electric barrier that does work right here in our own state. So we encourage the Senate to continue to look at AIS. It's very important. Again, we don't want to see these things spreading out through Minnesota. And I'll conclude my testimony there.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Mr. Ness? Thank you. Any questions from the author? Seeing none, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that Senate File 2264 as amended be recommended to pass and send...
Go to Senate Finance.
To the Finance Committee.
Members? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign? Very good. Thank you. Senator Peterson, Senate File 1560.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I need to offer the A1 amendment to get this bill into form, and then I need to ask the committee members to entertain a motion just to move this bill to the floor.
Senator Peterson, this is a delete everything amendment. The A1 amendment?
Yes, it's the A1 amendment. delete all, yes, sir.
We'll wait till everybody gets a copy of it here. Due to the fact that it's a delete all amendment, members. To the A1 amendment, members?
Mr.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign? Your bill is in order, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. To address the A1 amendment, we have some testimony for that this afternoon. It simply is some adjustments and compromise language from the state agencies and other interested parties relating to this this specific issue. And so it puts it in the same form as what's moving forward in the House and is actually on their general register in the House, which is the reason for your consideration this afternoon.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson, to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. When you first heard Senator Peterson's bill in this committee, you heard a number of folks from affected cities talking about water conservation results they had achieved without using conservation rates and their desire to not have to add water conservation rates when they were already meeting their desired water conservation goals. And so following that, we heard from a number of cities that actually do already have water conservation rates in place, did not want to have to redo those or have the mandate removed and be pressured to redo those, and they were getting good results from them. So we did a conference call among affected cities with the Department of Natural Resources and the League of Cities and other interested city groups and came up with the language that you have in front of you. What it is intended to do is make it so that if a city does want to keep their water conservation rate, statute still says that that's a supported thing for them to be doing. But if they would instead rather have a flat water rate and use other conservation methods to demonstrate that they're meeting conservation goals of their community, they have that as an option. And it clarifies that this is all done as part of the normal cooperative process of working out the local water plan, which is a water plan. DNR has a 10-year timeline that they try to work out with each community that has a water appropriation permit. So we think with those changes that this language makes it work for cities in either the case where they would still like to do a conservation rate and would like statutory support for doing that, already have one and want to keep it, or do not want to use one and want to use other methods, all three. And it's language that the department actually worked out for us so that they're comfortable with it as well. I would add, members, that it does do one additional thing that the department did not specifically request, but that my cities did, which is it extends the timeline they have to meet these requirements to the year 2015.
That extension is from what
date? From 2013 to 2015. It's a two-year extension.
Okay. Senator Scoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And blanking on your name.
It's okay.
Johnson. With regard to the water plan, now, if it's a city that is in a county that is doing a county water plan, is it then in conjunction with the county water plan, or how does that all work out?
I'm sorry, Senator. It's Mr. Carlson.
Nope.
Johnson.
Boy, it's all right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Nobody's kind of Williams around here today.
And Senator.
Senator Dietzick, you and I have got the name that nobody understands.
Yeah. Okay,
the water plan we're referring to here is the water supply plan. So that's a separate plan that's only done if you have a public water supply and a water appropriation permit from DNR. So you do a 10-year plan of how you're protecting that. It's everything, you know, the wellhead protection, all that kind of stuff has to be addressed, and how you're conserving water to make sure you're not going over your appropriation permits.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Members, any other questions from the author or Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
See none. Senator Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we'd ask that you move Senate File 1560 to the floor.
Okay, Senator Peterson makes a motion to Senate File 1560 be passed and go directly to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Period. Thank you. Folks, we got one bill left. I'm going to do it from here. It's the Game and Fish. Senate File 1943, Game and Fish Provision Modifications. I will have Mr. Knopf go through the bill as we did the policy bill just the other day. It seems to work out just fine that way. And if you have any questions, of course, I'll be looking for any questions at all. So I have to offer the A1, that's a delete all amendment. I think everybody has that in their packets. To the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, I'll just briefly go through what's in here. The first section was part of the Game and Fish bill that the DNR was suggesting. What they want to do is also include in their mission activities designed to recruit new outdoor recreation participants and retain existing participants. Section 2 was actually the DNR sent over some language the other day. What they want to do is allow the harvest of bullheads, gold eyes, moon eyes, sheep's head, and suckers for bait from streams and rivers designated as infested. So you can see the language there. This was actually a provision that is in here as a result of an email from DNR the other day. They're requesting that this be included. It's something they've worked out to be able to use those for bait. Also, Section 3 was something the DNR, there was some discussions in southeastern Minnesota, and this will line up with a section you'll see later in the bill. This is a definition of bonus permit to kind of get at that. We've seen Section 4 already in the Wolf bill and Senator Gazelka's bill on 1945, so that's already in the The deer license donations, that's just removing an old report that's already been given. Section 6 is it also as part of the department's game and fish bill, and this is eliminating a reporting requirement for money spent on emergency deer feeding and wild survey health management. My understanding, that's part of the regular game and fish fund report. Section 7, again, we saw on Tuesday dealing with the wolf bill. Section 8, this deals with vacating refuges that are open to hunting if they have a game refuge. This would allow them to do it by publishing a notice in the state register if they've had it open for already for 5 years, so it would not be a refuge anymore. It would basically be like a wildlife management area. Section 9 was from Senator Carlson's bill 1651 we heard earlier this session. It deals with a number that needs to be affixed to the stand that's left on a wildlife management area. Section 10, this deals with a big game license after conviction. This is, again, part of the department's game and fish bill. What it does is is if you're caught baiting, this person could also have his license. The person may not have paid. Actually, his license would be revoked for a year. And then also then it would double the revocation of either the baiting or current law conviction provisions. You can see on the bottom of page 4. For those that if it's the conviction is related to a trophy deer scoring greater than 170 and the wildlife restitution values, which I think are based on the Boone and Crockett. Section 11, it deals with owners and tenants of agricultural land. I mentioned that earlier. This is kind of an issue, especially in southeastern Minnesota. There were some discussions over in the House. Now, there needs to be a slight change in this provision, Mr. Chair. On 5.9, delete the new language, and then on 5.13, before the period, insert without making a lottery application. Apparently that clarifies it better so that they're not necessarily going into lottery areas. It's just that it's in the non-lottery areas. Somebody from the department talked to me about this earlier, and apparently they were looking to have that changed. If you want somebody to move that now.
Senator Carlson moves that amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
And then, Mr. Chair, Section 12 deals with the underage. That actually deals with the wolves. We already saw that.
We're going to have a little more activity there on our vote. So he moved that bill, and he voted for it, so that was it.
And Mr.
I'm sorry,
Chair.
Go ahead. We're getting a little pudgy here.
Section 12 is we saw that in the Wolf bill on Tuesday. Section 13, this deals with non-residents. What we're doing is we're removing non-residents from the resident provision for under 16 and big game, and we're creating a new section dealing with non-residents for big game. And this provides basically what the non-resident youth needs to do, and I think it's actually to purchase a license and pay the required fee, whereas the resident, we don't require them to pay the fee if they're 10 or 11 years old and they're basically just tagging along with a parent under the direct supervision.
What's the charge in that fee? I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Chair, that we do have an underage fee. I mean,
I'm not sure.
I think we'll have it in. You can actually see that later.
Okay, that's fine.
If you want to look at the fee for that, but it's... Mm-hmm. You'll see that in when we get to 97847, we actually do amend that section. So, Mr. Chair, and then these lifetime license provisions through Section 17 were all part of the Gazelka bill. Section 18, again, is a wolf provision. And you can see the fee, what we have for persons under the age of 18, we do have a reduced fee. For a resident, it's $13. You can see that on 8.32. And for non-residents, you'll see in Section 19, this is in here because of the wolf fee, which we heard in Senator Gazelka's bill. But if you want to see for a person under the age of 18 for a non-resident, it's also $13. So basically that non-resident youth will pay the $13 fee.
Okay, good.
And then, Mr. Chair, Section 20 was in Senator Gazelka's bill. Section 21, if you look on page 10, we're striking some language dealing with an application. This dealt with Social Security numbers. This was... And you can see there's an old date of January 1, 2006. So this is just an old requirement. It's not part of it anymore. Section 22, this is the taking with firearms in certain areas. This was Senator Tomasoni's bill, Senate File 1819. And again, remember the committee, Senator Dietzick brought up the point about the structure of the sentence where we moved a provision from the upper part from on 10.25 down to 10.27 to make it clear that it's the stockade or corral that the person owns. Section 23, this is from Senator Thompson, Senate File 2101 on the firearm safety, and you'll see on 11.9 that's the change that was in Senator Thompson's bill as it was amended by the committee. Section 24, this is again dealing with wolves. Same as Section 25, that deals with wolves. That was also in Senator Gazelka's bill. Senate File 26 is from Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill, 1962, and that deals with scopes on muzzle loaders. That was passed by this committee the other day. Section 27 was in Senator Gazelka's bill. Section 28 is something that was a part of the DNR bill. This is a slightly modified version of what they said. And this would say that current law basically says a firearm or arrow, and this would change it to a number 4 buckshot or larger across or within the right-of-way of a highway. And then Section 29, this is a blaze orange requirement. This just says when you're in your deer stand and you don't have any blaze orange, that you could take small game while you're in your stand if you see a rough grouse or a pheasant without putting an orange cap on. Section 30, this deals with wolves, and that was, again, part of Senator Gazelka's bill. Section 31, this deals with radio. Basically, we've got a prohibition on radio communication. But what this does, these are exceptions, and what this does is allow, you know, some of those newer communication systems with a dog, where the dog that has a GPS and gets back, this is to make sure that those aren't illegal, because right now it says one-way communication. You look on 14.6, and it also would allow for the remote-controlled motorized decoys for migratory waterfowl or doves. You know, you see the robo-doves or the other motorized decoys for waterfowl. Some of them have become remote-controlled, and there was a concern that those would be considered illegal under this provision under current law. Section 32, this was part of the department's bill, and it allows for a mounted gun or bow or with any electrical or mechanical device. This is basically for somebody, the physically disabled hunter. And then Section 33, this was from Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill, 1706, dealing with hunter-harvested venison that we heard on Tuesday. Section 34, this is a baiting provision that was recommended by the Department of Natural Resources in their bill. And I think that the important thing, they're trying to clarify what bait means and remove the word feed from the definitions. But also, if you look on 15.14 to 15.15, it doesn't cover agricultural crops that have been reintroduced and concentrated where a person is hunting. And then, Mr. Chair, Section 35 is a wolf provision. So Section 36 that you passed the other day in Senator Gazelka's bill. Section 37 is also a wolf provision. Section 38 is a wolf provision. Section 39, 40, those are all provisions exactly as the committee passed them in Senator Gazelka's bill. Section 41 last year the legislature modified this provision on the removal of beaver, especially with road authorities. And what this does is it removes the requirement that they must contact the conservation officer for a special beaver permit. Instead, that they can just take care of it without getting the special beaver permit. And this is Section 42. That, again, was part of the Wolf Bill, Senator Gazelka's bill. So was Section 43. Section 44, this deals with under current law, a few years ago, the legislature enacted a provision that required a four-week fall turkey season in the metropolitan area. And this would remove that requirement and basically leave it up to the commissioner to manage the turkey season in the metro area as the commissioner does in all other parts of the state. Section 45 allows an exception from the concealment provision for hunters hunting in open water. This basically, under current law, you can't except in certain instances. And then what this does is allows the commissioner by rule to establish areas where hunters could hunt waterfowl without being concealed. Section 46 is again part of the Wolf Bill that we heard the other day, Senator Gazelka's bill. Section 47 is the body gripping traps provision, Senator Carlson's bill, and this is as amended by the committee. Section 48, this again was a request by the DNR. They sent over an email on this. What they want to do is make some changes to the trout seasons, especially the winter season. And so what this does is it eliminates the statutory prescription for the winter season and allows the commissioner to do it by rule. You can see Section 49 is kind of goes along with Section 48 in that regard. Section 50 deals with, again, it's from the Wolf bill, from Senator Gazelka's bill. Section 51 is also from Senator Gazelka's bill. And Section 52 is also from that bill, so is Section 53. And then Section 54 contains a number of repealers. Two of them were in Senator Gazelka's bill. You do have an appendix in your, should be in your packet. And the first one is a hunting and fishing license reciprocity with Wisconsin. Second one is collection of deer and elk and bovine tuberculosis. So, and I want to reiterate, these were all recommended by the DNR. This is not; these are not provisions that were from any other bill. These were all, well, except well, there were two in the Wolf bill, but they were also recommendations of DNR. The receipts from fish and turtles from rough fish removal, the hunting on Muskrat Lake, the penalties for gray wolf. Again, that was in Senator Gazelka's bill. This special youth deer license that was enacted a number of years ago and is basically an obsolete provision based on the current system that we use. And then there's also a provision from back in the 90s when we were fighting with Canada over walleye limits. Fishing regulations executive order is a remnant of that. The gray wolf on the permit required to snare, that was again in Senator Gazelka's bill. And then the last provision that's in here is the lakes with unbalanced fish populations being repealed. And again, that was a recommendation of the department. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Members, any questions? Senator Saxon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anything in here on minnow importation or anything like that?
No, there's nothing in here. What kind of Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to bring up the venison donation.
I've got some for you.
You got some language on that?
Venison.
Oh, yeah. No, Mr. Chair, I think this is a real serious issue about requesting for the Department of Ag to somebody to have an exemption to the food statutes. And I was wondering maybe if there wouldn't be some way to change the definition so this is not subject to those statutes or some other mechanism that we could use so we're not
I agree with you.
Giving an exemption to the food statute.
Somehow to make it very clear, and I think that's what you're after here, is to make it very clear this is hunter-harvested venison and not food.
Somehow. I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, and I understand that. I understand, and people should know very well what they're picking up, what they're getting, what they have of, you know, that's being donated, and they certainly have the right not to take it as well. So So
as this moves along, and, you know, it's going to go to the floor, and yeah. I don't know, maybe Mr. Knopf wants to work on it over the weekend or something, but I'd like us to continue to think about what we're doing there.
Yep, I would too, yeah. I understand the concern. Members, any other questions? Any testimony at all? I'm not going to take any testimony over the bills that have already been heard, but if there's any other testimony with regards to the bill. Seeing none, members, all in favor of the bill, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Going to the judiciary. Better make that motion. Better make it very clear. Senate file 1943. Is there an appendix? I'm sorry, what? Oh, they haven't asked for it, but we can certainly do it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wasn't sure with some of the penalty provisions in here with taking a license away if the judiciary wants to see it. If they don't want to see that, you could send this directly to finance.
Boy, I don't know if I can answer for that. I'd say the judiciary doesn't want to see it. Well,
this morning's conversation.
No.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, it was you know part of the license restrictions, and I'm not sure if judiciary needs to see that. It isn't actually a penalty, but it's related to when you're subject to a gross misdemeanor penalty, where you take away the license for a longer period. I don't know if Senate judiciary needs to see that or not.
And Mr. Chair. Yeah. I think technically, don't bills all get sent to finance and then down to the divisions?
No.
Not anymore? Right. It would have been easy to fix that way.
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer will probably tell you if he wants.
I just sent it to finance.
Yeah, okay. I think what we'll do is we'll send it to finance. So Senate File 1560. I'm sorry. 1943. Boy, I'm losing it here. Too many numbers. I move that Senate File 1943 as amended to pass and to be sent to the Senate Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you, members. Appreciate that. And sorry again for the delay getting here, but we got out of here in pretty good time.
I just don't know if they want to see that or not.
Okay. All right.